This is a one-hour Building Bridges Your Community and Labor Report special, Running the Gauntlet, Union Organizing in the USA Today. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
While polls show nationwide support for unions, the percentage of unionized workers in the labor force declines each year. In this one-hour Building Bridges special, we'll talk with workers who have tried to form unions only to run the gauntlet of unfair labor practices, including firings. Even when the workers are successful, businesses frequently relocate or stall endlessly before a first contract.
Later on Building Bridges, we'll speak with fired Verizon Wireless worker from Westchester, New York, and a unionized Comcast worker in the Chicago area who is fending off union-busting efforts by that communications giant. We'll also ask AFL-CIO Director of Organizing, Stuart Acoff, what needs to be done to change labor law and to build a movement to organize the unorganized.
But first, we go to a recent New Jersey Congressional Forum on the Employee Free Choice Act, a labor initiative to reform the ineffective labor laws that permit wholesale violations of worker rights to organize. You'll hear from a number of workers and members of Congress. The forum was chaired by Congressmember Rob Andrews.
Forum on the Employee Free Choice Act. I am Congressman Rob Andrews from the 1st District of New Jersey. Ms. Muller is a registered nurse at Virtue West Jersey Hospital in Voorhees. She's with Genesso. Welcome.
I've been a registered nurse at Virtua for 27 years. I'm married. I have one daughter who's in college. She's hoping to become a registered nurse, a unionized registered nurse, as I am. In 1996, my coworkers and I decided to form a union. The hospital was eliminating positions, and this was causing concern for the safety of our patients and for the quality of care that our patients were receiving. They increased our health care premiums 2 years running, took away extra pay, and had not given us a raise for 3 years. When we began organizing, the hospital started an anti-union campaign. They hired a union-busting firm, and we received volumes of anti-union letters and leaflets. Nurses were pulled off patient care areas during work time to attend mandatory anti-union meetings, and several nurses were fired. Despite the hospital's campaign of intimidation, we won our election in April of 1996. Unfortunately, the hospital refused to accept our decision and challenged the election. The legal challenges took over 2 years to resolve and went all the way to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals denied the hospital's objections and certified the results of the election. Still, despite the court's ruling, the hospital continued to obstruct our rights by refusing to bargain in good faith. The NLRB issued complaints against the hospital, but this still did not force them to the table. What is their penalty for their blatant disregard for the law? They put up a letter in the back hallway on a bulletin board and says they were bad. Is that their penalty? They must be held accountable for their actions, and the Employee Free Choice Act can do this. We finally began negotiations in October of 1998. After numerous ineffective negotiation sessions, we were eventually forced to authorize a strike. Finally, in June of 2000, just a little over 4 years after we voted the union in, we were finally able to negotiate our first contract. We won raises, benefits, but most importantly, a voice in our work rules. Even after our four-year struggle, the hospital is still blocking the efforts of other workers at the hospital to form a union. Last month, the NLRB ruled against our paramedics, throwing out their ballots and negating their election. In this day and age, and in this country, it is frustrating and offensive that workers like me have to face such harassment and intimidation when exercising their legally protected rights. No one should endure threats to their livelihood, and no one should have to wait 4 years to have their choice recognized. Congressman, just imagine not being able to take office for 4 years because your opponent challenged the results of your election. You would not stand for it, and neither should we. I, along with my coworkers, hope you will support workers struggling to form unions in New Jersey and around the country and fight in Congress for a more fair process. Thank you.
Carol, thank you very much. We really would not want that long transition period, I assure you. The third witness is Mr. Paul Patterson, who is a support specialist at St. John's Community Services in Hamilton, New Jersey, member of CWA Local 1037. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Congressman. Hi, my name is Paul Patterson. I'm 61 years old. I've been employed by San John's Community Services for approximately 4 years. The last couple of years, they've gotten progressively worse on how they've handled their employees, to the point where I felt I had to get involved in an organizing campaign. Reasons being unfair disciplinary actions, safety issues, and care of our actual consumers that they were being paid for by the federal and state money. We started organizing in November. We filed the cards in December, held the elections in January. During this period of time, the company ran many anti-union meetings, one-on-one campaigns, lunches, dinners, and so forth. On January 8th, we held a meeting at the home which I worked in, which was the Academy Group home, and I challenged several of the statements that were made by our director of development, who was third in command for the company. After the meeting, he told me he would like to see me outside, at which time I went out, had a discussion with him. His comments to me were, "We all make choices. You made the wrong choice. You chose to back the union. You sealed your fate with San John's." I told him that I thought it was a point where some of the wrongdoings had to be straightened out, and I was going to hold with my move. On January 12th, the company held a very large meeting. It was a breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which was very good food. We had lobster, steak, some of the best breakfast foods you could. This was after many statements that they had no money to go union. The president of the company, Tom Wiles, brought in a union anti-organizing campaign group. After he presented his statements, I requested to have 5 minutes to dispute some of the comments he had made. The president, in front of everybody there, simply said to me, "This is my meeting. I pay for your food. Shut up." At that point, I said, "Yes, sir. You signed my paycheck." A week later, we had the elections. We won the election. They challenged the results of the election all the way up through D.C. To this date, they still have refused to negotiate a contract. I was elected as part of the bargaining unit. Since then, it's been all downhill for me. When I started with the organizing campaign, I was working 40-plus hours, making fairly good money. I'm currently working 15 hours a week, have no contact with my fellow employees. I've been removed from that home. I work with one individual in an apartment complex. I'm not allowed in the home unless I'm requested to be there for company business. Basically, they're doing everything they can to stop the negotiations. We had set dates for negotiation. They replaced the lawyer they had, went with another lawyer, and we're currently scheduled until their next move, where I'm sure they'll come up with another reason why not to sit down at the table. I'd like to thank this group for all your help in trying to rectify some of these problems from management. I'd also like to say that San John's is my first job in 40 years where I haven't been management, and they managed to convert me to a union employee. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Patterson, I assure you, your voice may have been silenced in the workplace, but it's heard loud and clear here. Ms. Acosta is a warehouse worker for H&M Company in Secaucus. She's a member of Unite Here.
Mi nombre es Ana María Acosta. Yo he trabajado en el centro de distribución de H&M en Secaucus, New Jersey, por los últimos 4 años. Hace 2 años, mis compañeros de trabajo y yo decidimos formar una unión con Unite Here.
My name is Ana María Acosta. I've been working at the distribution center at H&M in Secaucus, New Jersey for the last 4 years. 2 years ago, my coworkers and I decided to form a union with Unite Here. We did this to gain better benefits, health insurance, to increase our wages, and to have a voice in our working conditions. We were very concerned about the health and safety issues in our plant, especially since many of my coworkers had been injured on the job. Even though H&M is a Swedish company that has unions in Europe,
que tratan a sus trabajadores con dignidad y respeto.
And they treat their workers there with dignity and respect. Nevertheless, they did not treat us with that same dignity and respect. When the company realized that we were trying to form a union, they responded strongly with harassment, threats, and intimidation. The company also had anti-union meetings. They also showed anti-union videos, and they tried to dissuade us from joining a union. All of this was mandatory, and we were forced to listen to this. Many of my coworkers had already used the NLRB process of elections with their previous employers. Because of their bad experiences, we decided to avoid this proceeding.
Nosotros mismos decidimos lograr el reconocimiento por medio de un conteo de tarjetas. En agosto del 2003, Nosotros independientemente tuvimos un contrato.
We decided we wanted recognition by way of a card check agreement. In August 2003, we independently held a card check where we had a priest verify that we had a majority of workers sign union authorization cards. Nevertheless, the company did not recognize our decision, and they continued to harass us with retaliation, especially the union supporters. When I began to openly support the union, I wore buttons and a union t-shirt. They fired me. Approximately 20 of my co-workers were also fired. My co-workers, and especially Dayanita Bautista, who is here present, a woman of a lot of strength and courage, she fought inside of the plant so that I would be returned to my job.
Yo viajé a Suecia para hablar con la prensa sobre lo que estaba pasando en New Jersey. La prensa sueca y sus uniones estaban en shock. Y mi historia fue publicada en las primeras páginas de los periódicos.
I traveled to Sweden to talk to their press about what was going on here in New Jersey. The Swedish press and the Swedish unions were in shock. My story was published on the front page of their newspapers. Because of the negative publicity that H&M received in Sweden, they decided to offer us our jobs again. And they later decided to honor the results of a second card check agreement. In March of 2004, our decision to have a union was confirmed. And last month, we won our first contract. This includes benefits for part-time workers, pay increases, health insurance, we have a pension, we have vacation days, we have personal days, and we have a voice in our work.
Aunque estoy feliz de que H&M finalmente se puso de acuerdo en honrar nuestra decisión y negociar con buena fe, yo creo que no debí de ser despedida por haber participado.
Even though I'm happy that H&M decided to honor our decision and negotiate in good faith, I don't think I should have had to been fired for participating in union activities in order for them to recognize the union. And I also don't think that I should have had to fly all the way to Sweden to embarrass them so that they would be fair with us. All of the workers in this country have a right to form a union. And those companies that respect workers' rights to have unions in their own countries should not be permitted to violate our labor laws here in the United States. I urge you, I implore you to support workers who are in the same fight that I fought. And I urge you to fight in Congress for a just process that will enforce our rights.
Y derechos humanos.
Our legal rights and our human rights.
Y tener una voz en el trabajo.
And to have a voice in our job. Thank you very much.
Thank you so very much, Ms. Acosta. We are delighted with your victory, but we are appalled you had to leave your own country to achieve it. And we want to make sure that people don't have to leave this country to achieve that justice in the future. We're fortunate that our congressman and friend Bob Menendez speaks for Democrats all over the country. He is the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, and he has lent his voice to this effort all over the United States of America. He's a strong supporter of this effort, and I would ask you to join me in welcoming Congressman Bob Menendez.
Thank you very much. We are facing a fundamental and increasingly problematic era in workers' rights due to a law that has too many weaknesses. There are many employers who understand the loopholes and are willing to bully their workers without serious recourse to them in doing so. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935 was a promise to the country's workers of the right of self-organization, of free association, to form, join, and assist in organizing. And that promise has clearly eroded over the years. We have increasingly seen employers become bold in their anti-union tactics in recent years to the point where intimidation and harassment are becoming the rule, not the exception. And therefore, the need for stronger protections is about following through on our promise to promote a fundamental right to provide a free and fair workplace for American workers and to uphold the respect and dignity that workers deserve. It's not just simply our perception. This perception is matched by facts. If you look at what Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, said, he summarized the circumstances American workers face when trying to form a union. He said, loophole-ridden laws, paralyzing delays, feeble enforcement, have led to a culture of impunity in many areas of U.S. labor law and practice. Legal obstacles tilt the playing field so steeply against workers' freedom of association that the United States is in violation of international human rights standards for workers. And that observation is buttressed by the following facts. At least a quarter of all organizing campaigns end in employers unlawfully firing union supporters. More than half of all employers threaten to partially or fully close the plant of the union wins the election. More than half of all employers threaten to call the Immigration and Naturalization Service during organizing drives that include undocumented workers. 4 out of 5 employers require employees to attend one-on-one anti-union meetings. More than 2/3 hold such meetings at least weekly. And in 1/3 of all union election victories, workers still do not have a collective bargaining agreement 2 years after the election. Why is it that we want this fundamental right to be preserved on behalf of all workers in this country? We want it because there are distinct and obvious differences between a society in which it has unions and a society that does not. Listen to this fact. The 10 states with the highest percentage of organized workers have higher household incomes, greater medical insurance coverage, higher education spending per pupil, lower violent crime rates, and fewer people living in poverty and greater electoral participation than the 10 states with the lowest amount of organized workers. That is why we support the Employer Free Choice Act.
You've been listening to a congressional forum on the Employee Free Choice Act.
While there are fewer workers employed in what has been traditionally been unionized sectors of the economy, such as auto, garment, and textiles, there are new sectors like communications that are emerging, but where the workforce unionizing is in deep trouble. Telephone workers in particular had a strong union until the breakup of AT&T and the advent of wireless telephones.
Verizon, which is unionized in the older landline services, is union-free and wireless and is fighting fiercely to keep it that way. Comcast, a giant communications corporation dominating major markets in cable, telephone, and network services, started non-union and is busting unions in place.
We spoke with two workers from these companies who give a chilling account of the extent to which the companies go to maintain a union-free environment. These days, the focus of the labor movement and the point of much contention within it is how to organize the unorganized.
We're going to speak after this segment with Stuart Acuff, organizing director of the AFL-CIO, but now we go to the two workers.
Back in 35, the unions were growing. They were working hard and singing a union song. There was a lot of realizing that good old organizing was the only way to make the union strong. The only way to make the union strong. Oh, the companies paid out starvation wages, and their cruelty and greed were quite well known. And there was no law in the land that would lend a helping hand. The workers had to do it on their own. They knew they had to do it on their own. Franklin Roosevelt, he stepped out of the White House, and he said, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. He said, the country's on demand, and the government's your friend, and the Wagner Act, it is the thing for you. Wagner Act, it is the thing for you. So now the workers had a right to join a union, and this legislation seemed without a flaw. But standing in the foyers were 100,000 lawyers waiting for to tinker with a law, Lord, Lord, waiting for to tinker with a law. Oh, the strikes and the sit-downs and the boycotts kept the union movement growing fast. But the labor law kept changing, and all this rearranging was stripping away the weapons of our class. Lord, Lord, stripping away the weapons of our class.
Now Ty Gwen, fired customer service representative of Verizon Wireless, talks to us about being fired based on his efforts to organize a union.
Ty, why don't we start by talking about why you and other workers at Verizon Wireless decided to form a union?
We wanted to unionize to make the workplace at Verizon Wireless a little better. The workers at Verizon Landline were unionized, and they were getting better salary, better health care benefits. They weren't fired left and right for nominal things because they had someone to speak for them, whereas at Verizon Wireless, there was none of that, and, you know, you can fire for the pettiest of things because there's no one to speak on your behalf. That was some of the reasons why we wanted to be unionized.
When you say you could be fired for some of the pettiest things, for example?
It could be anything. I mean, the company didn't like you, you know, you basically were fired. Me and a few others were fired just simply because we were pro-union supporters.
And what happened when you started to start the union?
When we started talking to other reps about trying to form a union, we were singled out. We started getting written up for just about anything. Getting written up and warned about stuff. Anytime, the word union in Verizon Wireless is so taboo that a lot of the reps won't talk about it.
Were there meetings that management held with the workers?
Oh, yes. The first day of orientation, they have a human resources lady who comes in for about half an hour to 45 minutes, and basically she bashes the union for, you know, the full time, although she says it's our choice whether or not we want to unionize. But then throughout your training session, they would hold meetings that would be very anti-union. They have an internal website that posts negative news about the union or negative views about the union.
And how did the organizing drive proceed? Did you sign up many members?
Yes, we did. We would approach them any way we can, gave them information about the union, what benefits we would have if we were unionized. We did get a lot of people to sign up for it.
And then what happened?
Like I said, we would be targeted out by management, singled out, spoken to, disciplined on any number of reasons, and eventually they would find something, fire us. They would not blatantly come out and say that we were fired for our unionizing efforts, but they would find something here and there to come up with a reason to fire us. I was accused of being late. I was fired January 12th of 2004, being accused of being late on December 29th of 2003.
What are the implications for your family of having lost this job?
We're in a bit of a rut now because, I mean, it's been very difficult to find work. I have a 5-year-old daughter. It breaks my heart that I can't be able to provide stuff for her, so it's been very difficult.
And what happened to the facility at Orangeburg, New York?
It got to the point where our unionizing efforts got them, this is what I think, got them to decide to close down and move down to North Carolina. What do they call that? And free to work state or something like that?
Right to work state.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to form a union down there too, but yeah. It doesn't seem like there's much difference. What do you make of this experience and what could be done to facilitate union drives throughout the country? I mean, this seems not to be an uncommon situation.
I mean, it seems like it's difficult to want to form a union, especially with a company as large as Verizon Wireless. I think just people just need to be a little bit more educated about benefits of a union. And I think if more and more people knew what benefits they can get from unionization, they wouldn't be so scared to talk about it or to get more information about it at a place like Verizon Wireless. And I think that definitely would have made it easier. From my experience, the way I guess I was handling it at Verizon Wireless, I thought I was getting enough information to people and to enough people that we came close to at least getting Verizon Wireless unionized at that place. But I felt like we were just about there, and then they came up with something to get rid of me because it was that close.
There's an effort by the unions to amend the labor laws. Do you think that would help?
That possibly could help, yeah. I mean, anything to help, I guess, the regular workers, anything to help in that way would be a great big step in helping to form a union.
Ty, when you were let go, which we understand really that it was a ruse saying that it was about lateness and it was rather about your organizing activities, do you think there are any particular reasons that the members or that your colleagues that you were seeking to organize didn't really rise to the occasion and almost precipitate a crisis for Verizon Wireless over your firing?
I think because I was such a focal point with the unionizing effort, and I was such a major part of that. When Verizon Wireless fired me, it was to set an example, as in, say, Ty was such a major part of this unionizing effort, and we're going to go ahead and fire him, regardless of whether or not he was one of the best workers here. They looked at the other employees and said, we're not going to count my merits of work. They're just going to look at the fact that I was such a strong unionizing that they're just going to fire me for that, to set an example so if anyone else were to think about either following my footsteps or coming out and saying anything about the union, they felt like they can easily get fired as well.
But did the campaign itself destroy the campaign, or did people continue to sign cards? And
I think it weakened it a lot. After that, I wasn't sure how strong the effort was within Verizon Wireless, but I'm pretty sure it was definitely weakened by my firing.
And did the union, the Communication Workers of America, file an unfair labor practice suit?
Yes, they did. Communication Workers of America, the local 1105, definitely stepped in and filed a complaint with the labor board, and definitely were speaking on my behalf.
And what's the conclusion, if there's been one, about the filing of that? Because it is illegal to fire people based on their efforts to organize a union.
Correct. As of now, they haven't come to a conclusion. There was a court case in Manhattan, but as of right now, there is no conclusion.
And is there anything you would particularly, in these last moments, like to tell our listeners about your efforts to organize?
I think you want to help out. Just give as much information as you can to the other workers. I think what you should do is just boycott Verizon Wireless completely. I don't know what else, you know, they can do, or I don't have any other suggestions at this point of what else they can do, but...
Is there a effort among CWA to promote Singular Wireless, because that's the only one that's really unionized?
I did hear that, yes, and I think that there is a push towards Singular Wireless.
Would you be deterred from further organizing efforts?
I don't know, I mean, I've seen the benefits of forming a union, and that definitely outweighs what's happened to me. I mean, even now, being fired, I still go to the union rallies, and I still do things that I think, even if it doesn't help me, at least it'll help the other workers, help someone.
Why are you so convinced that unionization is an imperative thing for the representation of and preservation and enhancement of workers' rights?
I'm just tired of seeing the workplace as a temporary job thing rather than getting employees and having them feel like a career that they can be proud of and secure of. The fact that people are hired and being scared into worrying day to day about whether or not they're going to have their job the next day, it doesn't make for a good work environment. And sometimes I felt like going to work, I felt like more like I was a slave rather than an employee with a company. I don't think a workplace should be like that.
You've been listening to Ty Gwen, fired customer service representative, trying to organize a union at Verizon Wireless. We're speaking with Kevin Bialas, service technician for Comcast Communications Corporation, working in the metropolitan Chicago area, and he's a shop steward with IBEW Local 21.
Kevin, unlike a lot of the people we're hearing from on this program today, you have a union, but the company's trying to get rid of the union. Why don't you start by telling us how you got to this point?
When I started work back in 1998, the cable companies were all a bunch of little companies, and I worked for Jones Intercable, which was 100% union. Subsequently, AT&T bought out a bunch of the little companies, merged them all together, and now in the Chicago region, there's only one company, which is Comcast. Some of the other smaller shops that were not union, that were different companies at that time, make up the majority of the Chicago market. So with AT&T and Comcast, we have been in negotiations with them since our contract expired in June of 99. And since then, we're really no closer on the major issues than we were back then. All the stalling tactics that I wasn't aware of prior to seeing it firsthand, of everything from canceling bargaining sessions because they just didn't have enough time to review our material, which the last time we met was 2 months earlier. So it's been a very big challenge to try to keep the membership up after 6 years of not having contractual raises or anything else. But our members, I think, really do realize that without having a union would be in a much worse situation.
I think it's helpful if you can even further elaborate on some of the mechanisms, tools that they used in order to begin the process of trying to bust the union.
It's been an onslaught. The main thing they do is they hold captive audience meetings with their weaker units and they tried to convince them that the company is so much better without a union and they can have $3 and $4 more an hour. Even went so far in a desert campaign to bring in cookies that said vote no. In one shop, they were taking them out to breakfast 2 and 3 times a week leading up to a desert vote. The company lost that desert vote. We have successfully gotten about 10 people their jobs back in the last 2 years that were fired illegally or tried to be laid off, but because of the contract, they definitely got their jobs back through an grievance and arbitration procedure.
Has the union been trying to organize new units in Comcast?
They have. Back in 2000, they organized Chicago South, and because the company stalled at their bargaining table, after 2 years, the employees finally succumbed to the company and voted the union out. Now that office, all the people are being shipped to different parts to limit the people that were the strong organizers of the union to avoid a reorganization drive. But the IBEW is actively pursuing more units. It's just very difficult. Comcast has made no secret that they'll be willing to do almost anything to keep unions out of the Chicago market as well as the rest of the country.
Have they been moving work from your facility or moving workers out of it?
I work more on the technical end, so it's much more difficult for them to move that work. But they have moved a lot of the dispatch functions and the customer service functions. They've moved them out of those offices and moved them into bigger non-union offices and then told those people, you don't have a union anymore because we have more non-union people here. They tried last June in our Libertyville shop up north. They told the 10 people that worked up there that they were going to close that office, and if they didn't transfer to non-union areas, that they would essentially lose their job. Unfortunately, most of the people did transfer out to different jobs. One of our members told them that he would make them lay them off because the contract says that if they lay them off, they would not be able to use any subcontractors in those areas. And it's a big chunk of the north region of the Chicago area. So to this day, he's the only technician that's working in the field up there, but they have to leave that office open because of his contract. So I think, you know, with that contract that's in place there, it speaks volumes for how much, you know, one person can make a difference.
Paint a more vivid picture for us if workers are left totally to the mercy of the bosses without collective bargaining agreements.
One of the major things that I hear, and I attend some of the meetings with the organizers that actually are talking to non-union Comcast people, is the company expects that you're available for them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The company has taken the position that they're going to contract out about, in my area, it's about 98% of the work to subcontractors, and it's pretty high in the non-union areas as well. They're trying to limit their wages, any of their overhead as far as benefits, 401ks, pensions, anything of that nature. On a typical day, they may send a technician out with an exorbitant amount of jobs that in a non-union shop, they have to finish those jobs before they can go home. The big thing I hear from people is they're doing 10, 12-hour days. Then near the end of the week, if it's slow, they've worked all this time. The company will send them home in order to avoid overtime. I believe that there is going to be a labor push, even from the non-union side, because of the treatment. It's just Comcast is just the big Goliath in the whole thing. They make no secret to try to limit anybody's voice in the workplace, whether it's union or non-union.
You've been testifying at congressional events and union events about your experiences. How have those gone?
They've gone very well. With the support in the groups of like the AFL-CIO and Jobs with Justice, and now new legislation like this Employee Free Choice Act, it's starting to get out there that, unfortunately, in America, more corporations don't want you to have a voice in the workplace, even though the majority of the workers are the ones that are making these companies truly successful. Because the workers, non-union and union people that I know, they're great workers. They're very hardworking. They're dedicated. They just want to be treated fairly. And the message we're getting from Comcast is that they're not interested in that. They just want you to...
Are these closed sessions, or have you actually gone out on the street and done this?
I have done both. And I personally feel that it has to be a roots effort of the members, because that's really what gets the members and of and employees of the company is really what gets the attention of the company, because that makes them, that's what's going to make them want to negotiate, is the power of the people that work there for them.
As someone who's involved in union organizing, who's a shop steward and at a critical juncture in the development and maintenance of the organized
labor movement. What do you think needs to happen to stimulate the public in general to be receptive to and want to be part of unions?
A big job in the labor movement, they need to be very vigilant on education of the members and the public. We have to remember our history. I saw a bumper sticker once that rings true that it said, "Enjoy the weekend," brought to you by the labor movement. The labor movement in the past has brought us 8-hour work days, overtime, even, you know, helped when they used to use the children in labor. We have to get back to that, and I think a lot of even our own members and the public in general is complacent as to the importance of labor and the history of labor and the future of labor is going. I think education is the number one thing, and remembering and educating about the history and where things come from, because prior to me even working here, I didn't really know much about the labor movement. My perception of my dad's generation was, you work for a company, they treat you fair, they treat you decent, and you retire, and we're just not seeing that in this day. I truly believe greed amongst CEOs and, you know, these people at the top are pillaging these companies, and the workers are really the ones that ultimately suffer. So if they want their share of the pie, they're going to have to stand up and take it and tell people that that's what they're after and that's what they want to get and to live out their lives decently.
And Kevin, where are you off to now? I know you were rushing to catch a plane.
I'm leaving for Pittsburgh this morning to attend a town hall meeting that's set up by the AFL-CIO and the CWA to talk about the Employee Free Choice Act and the need for unions in this country.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Kevin Biala, service technician for Comcast Communication Corporation, working in the Metro Chicago area. He's a shop steward of IBEW Local 21.
The list of rules and laws kept getting longer, and the government would go to any lengths to make up some amendment to keep us more dependent on the labor laws instead of on our strength. Labor laws instead of on our strength. So when Ronald Reagan came into the White House and he steered this country sharply to the right, by the time his big steamroller crushed the air traffic controllers, well, the union had forgotten how to fight. Lord, Lord, the unions had forgotten how to fight. Now you want to pass another law to save the union, and you say this bill is fair and just and wise. Well, that is fine and dandy, but something much more handy would be if once more we learned to organize. If once more we learned to organize. Because the union's strength is in its independence, and the laws are made to keep us solid base. So kick your leaders in their asses, let's organize the masses. That's the only way we'll win the day, Lord, Lord. That's the only way we'll win the day. That's the only way we'll win the day, Lord, Lord. That's the only way we'll win the day.
Well, the AFL-CIO has recently decided to spend more money on political work and rebate millions to its international unions to organize workers. We're joined by Stuart Acuff, organizing director of the AFL-CIO, to discuss these issues. Stuart Acuff has been a community and labor organizer for 25 years. Why don't we begin by, for example, the examples we've looked at of workers getting fired, of businesses moving away, of intimidation when trying to form a union. How widespread are these abuses? And welcome to WBAI's Building Bridges.
Thanks. It's good to be with you. These examples of workers being intimidated and otherwise abused by employers for trying to form unions and other related union activity are much, much too widespread. In fact, it's a common part of corporate culture in America today. The National Labor Relations Board's own conservative figures will show you that 20,000 workers in America every year are victimized, fired, and otherwise retaliated against for trying to form a union or related union activities. Kate Bronfenbrenner at Cornell has done the research which shows the length and the depth to which employers will go to fail to honor workers' rights and to do anything that they can to keep workers from building their own worker power.
One of the tactics that the AFL-CIO and the unions are trying on, there have been pushes in the past, and there's a new push to enact a reform of the labor laws called the Employee Free Choice Act. Tell us about what that would do and what the possibility of enacting such a piece of legislation while the Republicans are still in control of the Congress.
Well, first let me explain what happens when workers try to form a union. Employers can delay the process, they can intimidate workers, they fire workers, and there's very little penalty for firing workers who try to form a union, threaten workers, threaten to close a facility, on, and drag out the process for weeks and even months at a time. So this bill would do three things. One, it would say that workers could form a union by signing a card. More than 50% at a given work site sign a card or a petition saying that they want to form a union, and that would be recognized and they would be certified as a union. We generally call that card check, and that's being used more and more. In fact, in 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was originally passed, that was the most common way that workers had to declare their desire to form a union. So that's the first thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do. The second thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do is create real penalties for employers who violate the law. Triple damage penalties when you fire or suspend somebody for union activity. Allow unions for the first time in the history of this country to go to court and get an injunction for employer abuse. Well, of course, employers have been able to enjoin unions from the beginning. And then the last thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do is provide for mandatory mediation and even arbitration at the end of the first year after workers have formed a union to keep employers from avoiding signing a union contract. You can't get it done between the union and the employer. After a year of trying, okay, then we'll mediate and then arbitrate it. The bill would go a long way towards restoring the fundamental freedom of workers in America to form unions and bargain collectively. Now, it wouldn't clear up every problem and every abuse, but it would go a long way towards giving those 57 million workers in polling who say they would form a union today if given a chance, that chance. When the bill was first introduced in November of 2003, in that Congress, we got 208 co-sponsors in the House, just 10 shy of a majority, and 37 co-sponsors in the Senate. Today, we had to reintroduce it, new Congress, so we reintroduced it in April of this year. We have almost 200 co-sponsors in the House and 38 co-sponsors in the Senate. So we are building support. Now, even if we could get this bill passed with a Republican-controlled Congress, George Bush will never sign it. But we cannot wait till the time is right, because if we wait, the time will never be right. We have to use this time that we have to broaden the constituency of support to restore the right to organize, deepen the constituency of support, and build as close as we can to a movement of workers, both union and non-union, which understands that so much of what's ailing the country is directly tied to the suppression of worker power, is directly tied to trying to eliminate or at least greatly cut back on worker power by stopping workers from forming unions.
We're speaking with Stuart Acuff, Organizing Director of the AFL-CIO, and since you mentioned worker power, what about building movements where workers are empowered? It doesn't seem that either Service Employees International Union or the AFL-CIO are really speaking about movement building, for example, the involvement of members such as the ones we heard earlier who were testifying from the New Jersey Town Hall meeting to change the labor law. What's that process about? What's happening?
Well, I agree with you that we're not talking enough about building mass movement. The truth of the matter is the fundamental source of power for this labor movement or any labor movement in the country is workers united and in motion. That is our fundamental source of power, and I think that's where we ought to be focused, and John Sweeney believes that as well. The truth of the matter is that from September of 2003 through the election, we had the largest period of mobilization over 18 months in decades. 100,000 people in September and October of 2003 participating in the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride. We had 20,000 union workers marching and protesting the FTAA summit in Miami. Just 3 weeks later, December 10th, International Human Rights Day, 40,000 workers across America demonstrated to change the labor laws and to enact the Employee Free Choice Act. Then we had 500,000 union volunteers engaged in the election process. So we actually do believe in mobilization. We believe in it greatly. Frankly, this debate has been way too much about structure and way too much focused internally and not nearly enough focused externally. And we haven't been talking to unorganized workers enough. We've been much too consumed with our internal business and not nearly externally focused enough. I think when we get past this convention where President Sweeney will be reelected, you'll see the external focus again. But your point is well taken. We don't know, none of us know how to create movement or movement would have been created. But we do know elements of movement. We know that there's got to be a degree of creativity. We know that there's got to be room for spontaneity, for people to act on their own. We know that we have to create movement. We have to be willing to take chances and take risks. And frankly, facing the worst assault that we've faced in 80 years, since I would argue since the Palmer raids of 1919, the most right-wing government that our country's had in modern history in at least 70 years, that we have to be willing to do those things that can energize movement, that have the potential to generate and initiate movement. I will say this, that today Kevin went to Pittsburgh and testified at a great hearing in downtown Pittsburgh. 350 people attended this hearing, members of Congress, elected officials from up and down the latter attended the Congress, that CWA, the Communication Workers of America, this union that along with the electrical workers is fighting Comcast, has said exactly what you said, that in fact we not only have to work this bill in traditional ways, but we have to mobilize our members, our rank and file, to be willing to fight for this change and other changes. And of course, there are many other changes. And the truth of the matter is that I think if you look at when the labor movement grows, if you look at when workers take steps forward, when you can really see changes and improvements in quality of lives, when workers have a chance to lift their kids out of poverty, it's not done in isolation. It doesn't happen in isolation. It happens in the context and in the midst of a broad, strong, vibrant, progressive movement. And so that's why the AFL-CIO is not just talking about this legislation. Indeed, we are. It's a huge priority. We've got to someday see it passed. But we're also talking about saving Social Security. We're talking about saving the private pension program. We're talking about a fight to restore health care in this country and to end the stagnancy of our wages. But you can't separate the health and vitality of a working people's movement from a broader social struggle.
The AFL-CIO has decided to spend more money also on organizing by issuing rebates to international unions to organize. Will this work? I mean, it seems to me as if a lot of the unions will take the money and will just say that the money that they're using to organize anyway is this money, and you won't really get any new organizing done.
Well, that's something that we have to be really aware of and really diligent about. The unions that have challenged President Sweeney would, in fact, take half the resources of the AFL-CIO and give it in rebates, and we just don't think that's wise. You think you cripple the AFL-CIO, you'd end our ability to do a year-round political and issue mobilization and the kind of robust legislative public policy lobbying activity that we have to have. But we are going to try rebates. We are going to try smaller rebates that are tied to two things. One is how much money that union has moved internally to organizing with an accountability process. That's one. And two, the other more difficult elements of organizing capacity building. Is the union putting their best people on organizing? Have they put together a research staff to research the vulnerabilities of employers in their core jurisdiction, in their economic sector? Are they training those organizers and researchers rigorously? Do they have a program to move their rank-and-file members into organizing and organizing support? Are they using their bargaining power to leverage organizing rights for organizers under the same corporate umbrella who aren't union? Is their leadership fully engaged in organizing? We believe that the two things that have to happen to move greater success and progress on organizing is, one, what we've been talking about, having a real fight in this country, a real fight about the right to freely form a union and bargain collectively, that's one, and two, building the capacity of the labor movement across the entire labor movement, building the capacity to organize effectively and to organize outside of what is frankly a bankrupt National Labor Relations Board election process.
Stuart, certainly the answer is not just bringing masses of people together for a one-shot deal, if you will, but I can't help but think that next year there's going to be a millions more demonstration that is being presided over or stimulated by the Minister Louis Farrakhan. There are many other people that are involved in the effort. I keep thinking about Medicaid and Social Security and the election process and the Supreme Court process, which has many employment-based issues, and wonder why the labor movement is not calling out its masses of workers to present a physical presence in opposition to the backwardness of the Bush administration and the policies that stem from it, including these policies that are antithetical to workers mm-hmm. being able to organize unions. Mm-hmm. It would create a kind of, at least a pizzazz, an interest, a visibility in the consumer market as well of workers and worker power in all its physical glory, in all its numerosity.
Well, I mean, you make a good point. One thing, one of the questions, the strategic or tactical questions we struggle with, if you will, is do you focus that kind of power just on Washington, or do you demonstrate that kind of power across the country where more workers can actually participate? And as I said a while ago when I went through the litany of 18 months of mobilization across a wide spectrum of economic issues, we had decided at that time to spread the mobilizations, if you will, across the country. And of course, last year we put an awful lot of focus again on the elections because we understood how dangerous George Bush is. That there was a fundamental difference. Maybe it wasn't enough difference for us, and maybe we would have wanted more difference, but there was a fundamental difference between the agenda of the radical right-wing Republicans and the Democrats. As I say, after this election, we will look at again, at ways to mobilize to demonstrate a worker power across the country. And we do know that this year, again, on December 10th, International Human Rights Days, there will be major mobilizations all over the country to support this legislation we've been talking about and to support fundamental worker rights in the country. And then as other occasions come along, as other occasions come up, as there are other opportunities, we'll be looking at that as well. I can tell you that thousands of federal workers are mobilized from all over the country are mobilizing in Washington, D.C. to say no to the Bush administration's efforts to destroy collective bargaining in the federal workplace. They've now targeted 1 million federal workers to strip of collective bargaining rights. And so the mobilizations, the movement, the actions, the demonstrations, that is all critical to our future. And as I said earlier, I believe that the unfortunate part of this debate is we've talked too much about structure and too much to ourselves and not enough about movement and not enough to the rest of the country.
Time is running short and it perhaps deserves a longer response, but a lot of these mobilizations that we see, at least in this area, are very small demonstrations set up for the press, which really don't involve a lot of workers. It seems as if this is what the AFL-CIO wants, the Central Labor Councils aren't instituting this.
Well, that certainly wasn't the case with the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, where I think 50,000 people joined together in New York City. And it wasn't the case on December 10th of 2003 when I think 2,000 people were at the National Labor Relations Board headquarters. It wasn't the case.
Although, Stuart, I have to say that there really didn't appear to be any. We were at the Freedom Ride, and there were about 40,000 people, and there really wasn't anything that was a follow-up. There was nothing for the people who gathered there to do. The Freedom Rides of old.
Look, we may be vulnerable on the question of whether or not there was adequate follow-up. I would argue that there's been a lot of follow-up, particularly in the Congress, but 40,000 people is a whole lot of people in the Freedom Rides consumed 6 weeks between September and October of that year and covered the length and breadth of this nation. It was a huge mobilization. So, and then, you know, the question of small demonstrations wasn't the case when I was in New York in May when the graduate workers went on strike at Columbia, and we had a huge rally at Columbia and a march down Broadway involving higher education workers from all over New York City.
Well, you know, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We certainly do grant that there have been organizing efforts. There need to be absolutely more, and the workers need to assume their power, and we need a powerful, strong, organized workers' movement in this country to assume the wealth that it created. We've been speaking with Stuart Acuff, Organizing Director of the AFL-CIO, and we thank you very much for spending time with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
For more labor news and views, go to www.buildingbridgesradio.org for archived Building Bridges national labor shows.
And if you'd like to get in touch with Building Bridges, you can write Mimi, that's M-I-M-I, at buildingbridgesonline.org. Ken and I would love to hear from you.